You've joined the Betamax Video Club, rewinding back to our favourite films of the 1980s. My name's Rich Nelson, and tonight I've rented The Living Daylights. Watching it with me is Alice Dryden. Hi, Alice, how are you?
Hi, fine, thank you.
Thank you for finally getting together. We're doing the fourth Bond film of the 80s, Timothy Dalton's first. What's so special about this film for you?
Well, it's one I have a very clear memory of watching for the first time. I was at boarding school. I was maybe 14, 15. I'd been a Bond fan for a couple of years. I'd read the books. I'd watched the back catalogue and I thought, well, these are fun, these are cool, but that's not quite how I picture Bond. Living Daylights was shown on ITV, might even have been its first terrestrial showing back then. You had to wait years and years. Yeah. And straight away it looked fresh and contemporary. It was the first one I'd seen that looked like it was happening now, and Bond, bloody hell, he was the Bond in my head instantly.
It's funny that this film came out in 1987, and we're recording this on the day that I brought the A View to a Kill episode out. Now, from one film to another, this was almost a reboot, as big a or a drastic a change as we had from Die Another Day to Casino Royale. Timothy Dalton was eyed up for Bond films in the past, but this was his first time. I mean, we've talked on social media before about Timothy Dalton being very different, and, you know, he takes it far more seriously, and, you know, he talked in the interviews about being a Fleming Bond and going back to the novels. Now, you're sort of big into spy literature. Having read the books, is he more what you picture a James Bond to be than sort of latter-day Roger Moore?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a bit in Moonraker, which is my favourite of the books, and Moonraker actually resembling the novel starring Timothy Dalton is my ultimate fantasy Bond movie. And there's a description of Bond, and he's described as saturnine, which is kind of gloomy and dour and maybe a bit dangerous, and that passage and that word, I think that's why it's Dalton for me.
I mean, this in particular, the title was based on a short story, and sort of jumping ahead slightly, the whole short story premise was lifted for the Bratislava sniper scene. Obviously, it was taken from Berlin in the book, but it was sort of strange how that was lifted very nicely. A lot of people, when I talked about doing this film, they said that was the best part of the best short story that they did. But it's difficult to look back now when you look at the films that we've had more recently, where, other than Casino Royale, they've very, very rarely acknowledged the books at all. And yet this one, other than a slight change of location to bring it up to date, I guess at this point about 30 years, it was very similar to how that story went.
Yes, and it's over very quickly, but it is the inciting incident that the whole film is based around. Really, you could lop off the pre-credit bit and just start with Bratislava, so it is a key part of the story.
Yeah, it's a surprise sort of having come. I mean, I didn't read it until maybe a handful of years ago, and seeing or reading that story, and it's difficult to read a book after you've seen the film or anything like that, because all you can think about is it's Timothy Dalton and change the location and the premise very slightly, but, you know, so much of it was a direct lift. It was sort of refreshing to see in a way that you don't get anymore. I mean, what I said on a previous episode, how when I read Bond books, I almost always see Connery, but this one, it's Dalton, and that's all the better for it.
Yes, and he's got a fed-upness about his job that is very much from the books. I mean, Roger Moore, he loves being James Bond, you can tell. He's never going to say, oh, I hope M fires me, stuff my orders. He's all up for it.
I mean, the whole introduction to this film, the pre-credit sequence, we're introduced, I mean, it's a brand new Bond. There is a little bit of subterfuge at the beginning because he's not immediately introduced to us. There's an exercise for three 00 agents to test the radar installations of Gibraltar. A bit of a mouthful. M's office on a plane. So the three agents parachute out, they're given this brief, and the SAS are on hand. It's one of the earliest recorded games of paintball. But did you notice that of the three agents who landed, they parachute down onto the rock, one of them looks a bit like Roger Moore, and the other, the one who dies falling off the cliff, looked a little bit like George Lazenby.
yes, I've never thought of that. What I mostly notice is that all other 00 agents are completely incompetent because they always die off.
Yeah, and you imagine they must get the same training or train to the same standard as Bond, but Bond, you know, he always seems to get through these scrapes, and yet we've had 004 falling off a cliff here. We had 003 in The View to a Kill was dead with the chip and in his locket.
And 009 in Octopussy?
Yes.
They're definitely recycling the numbers, aren't they?
Yeah, and we had a couple of films later, we had Sean Bean as 006.
I'll give him a pass because he was faking it.
Yeah, yeah. He was a...
it's a... 00s who aren't 007 always die. This is a great opportunity for me to defect.
Playing the long game. We are introduced to... And you know, it's, I mean, I suppose you can't miss it. And I mean, these days, you'd never get away with it. But imagine if you walk into a Bond film not realising that you've got a new James Bond. You see Timothy Dalton as he looks to hear 004 falling off the cliff, the fella cutting the rope. He just has that look straight away, sort of looking over his shoulder.
Yes, it's like, you're the star. Yeah. You're the star around here.
You are Bond.
Yeah.
So I'm drinking tea out my your Living Daylights mug. It's getting into character a little bit.
Not everyone gets to borrow that. Only special guests.
As 004, he's cut from the rope as he's trying to climb up. And the fella who... he almost looked like Stephen Burkoff, going back to him again. General Orloff lives. Drops a little tag down there, which we find out later says Smeert Spioman, which was the original amalgamation of Smirch.
Smirch, who rough Bond up in Casino Royale.
Yeah, it's a whole sort of strange thing. I guess if, to me when I was younger and I didn't realise any of this, and it's explained a little bit more later on, but you don't realise until you see the films and read the books that Smirch, you know, really were the original evil organisation before Spectre came along and then disappeared suddenly due to an ongoing legal dispute. But yeah, I mean, from your reading of the novels, would that be a callback that you'd like to see Smirch's return?
Yes, and I like the way they handle it in The Living Daylights because it's a very Cold War thing. You know, the Berlin Wall's not down yet in 87, but it's coming, Glasnost is going on. So this is a sudden, oh, it's the bad old days.
Well, looking back now, I mean, this was kind of one of the last, I suppose, of that era where, you know, the Soviets or the KGB were the enemy, and there was a lot of talk of, you know, the death to spies and defections and things like that, where you just don't get that anymore. I mean, everything now is Bond going rogue or something. But
yeah, and anyone can turn up all over the world. There isn't this, oh, I've got to get behind the Iron Curtain.
Yeah.
You just, you know, go on TripAdvisor and buy your ticket.
No visas required. Bond manages to find this guy, and he was referred to in the credits as the imposter. So I guess this was a strange character.
So he must have sneaked in somehow.
Yeah, you know, he was dressed as sort of in some sort of army gear.
Because he's not Necros, because he gets messed up at the end.
The part when I made a note of the SAS guards, they shoot Bond as Bond's chasing him in a Land Rover. Hold on your day. And for some reason, that always stuck with me when I was a kid, because this was the first Bond film I saw at the cinema. And that was one of the first things I remember. It always seems to have stuck with me. It's this sort of SAS geezer. Hold on, you're dead.
Bond has no time for your baby games.
Your paintball.
The guard that Bond shoves rudely out of the way at the gate is Paul Weston, who was a stunt guy and stunt coordinator on a ton of Bonds.
Oh, yeah, I read about that.
Yeah, I saw him at a fan event, and he had a signing table, and he was talking me through his photo collection, and it was, and this is me on fire. This is me jumping from one cable car to the other. I was a bit in love with him by the end of this conversation.
What a CV. Here's me on fire.
And I asked him about the Land Rover chase, because a lot of the time it is clearly Dalton on the roof there. And he said, oh yeah, when it wasn't me on the roof, I was inside holding Dalton's leg so he wouldn't fall off.
So he was involved at all times.
We owe him a great debt for ensuring that Timothy Dalton did not die filming the pre-credit sequence.
I mean, I love the fact that, you know, we're talking the first 5 minutes of this Bond film, Bond headbutts someone.
He likes a headbutt, doesn't he, this Bond? It's not the only time he does it in his tenure.
It's good to see. It's refreshing. A bit more real world. You know, I suppose there's some things you just can't take out of Bond films. Of course, the Land Rover has to have some volatile explosives in the back, which cause some issues. But as they're driving around Gibraltar, he scares some monkeys, and the Land Rover goes off the edge in Gibraltar, which I was told recently that I think it was Ellen Cheshire who said that that was filmed in Beachy Head.
Oh.
And she put some pictures on. She does some filming Sussex stuff. And, of course, the cynical me just kind of, well, I'm sure that's not the only car that went off Beachy Head that weekend. But that, it was strange, sort of. And again, this is something that I suppose it, you see in the edit, that you don't notice that the immediate cut from lovely sunny Gibraltar to Sussex. Yeah, bringing it back down to earth, literally. But Bond has his parachute on. Lands on the, just happens to be a boat with a bored, glamorous lady looking for a real man.
And a phone.
Yeah.
Luckily.
A phone that's about the size of my car.
I love that phone, and I'm pretty sure we see it again later in the film. Can't think where, but I'm sure it's the same phone because they cost about $1,000 each at the time.
It looks like the one that Koskov takes the phone call on later on.
Yes.
Yeah, the villa. We've got Dalton sort of dropping in on this lady who's really badly dubbed. Because if you've seen the trailer for this, she had an American voice.
Oh, no!
It's on the DVD extra. She's, like, the original trailer, she's got an American voice, and they dubbed her over with whatever it is.
Who are you?
Bond. James Bond. 007 here. I'll report in an hour.
Won't you join me?
Better make that two.
He sort of turns up and phones Mission Control. And as soon as she offers him a glass of champagne, it's, I'll be reporting in an hour, better make it two. Yeah. He's confident.
Yeah. I've checked in and done my duty.
Yeah, it's not 1 hour, 5 minutes.
He's got to get his parachute off.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to take a while.
Cut the lace off the boots and things. You know, he's got... so we get the credits. What's your opinion? Now, I'm going to be slightly skewed by the fact that I'd ask about your view of the theme tune. Within My Eyeline is the 7-inch single of A-ha's The Living Daylights.
It is one of my favourites. I like Bond themes when they manage to hit the zeitgeist. And that's different every time, and some of them hit and some of them miss. I think Shirley Bassey, first time round, Matt Mumro, they just hit that 60s feeling. Wings did it in the 70s. Mm. And I think both Duran Duran's View to a Kill and A-ha's Living Daylights just got it right, and License to Kill I don't like so much. It feels like it's trying to be a 60s theme and not quite getting there.
Yeah, it's funny, I always sort of had in my head that the Duran Duran and the A-ha songs were paired.
Yes,
I mean, they were quite close
they
together.
They feel that way.
Yeah, they're very similar, despite the fact the films are sort of grossly different. And there were stories that apparently A-ha wrote the song with John Barry and he didn't particularly like them.
Oh, there was some kind of...
And you could tell that the music throughout the film is a lot more based on the Pretenders song.
Yes. It's quite a soft soundtrack in a lot of parts. It's got a lot of repeats of that romantic theme.
It's nice that, again, like Tomorrow Never Dies, they had the K.D. Lang song at the end, which was, I guess, originally supposed to be the main one, and Sheryl Crow suddenly became available. And this one, the Pretenders, which, and their song, Where's Everyone Gone, just sort of plays throughout the headphones and Necros the Henchman goon throughout.
Because I can remember when the internet didn't quite have everything in the universe on it back in the newsgroup days of alt-fan James Bond. People asking, what is that song that he's listening to on his Walkman? And you couldn't just Google it.
It's funny that, bear in mind, his method is strangling people with his headphones. They couldn't get the stranglers.
Oh!
Told you some bad jokes.
Out.
Right.
Off the balcony. Go on. It's only four floors.
So as we said, we've had the credits. We cut to Bratislava. Now this is the part of the short story. Joins in. We've got Saunders, who's the stuffy head of the Vienna section.
Everything by the book.
Yeah, everything by the book. And I just wrote Alexander Armstrong-esque.
Oh, wouldn't that be lovely? I'd love to see him in that kind of...
He's one of these people that you, I suppose you're immediately set up to think, oh, God, what pain.
Pen pusher.
Yeah, the person that... The
beam
anti-bond.
Counter.
Yeah. And so they're watching some, again, very unposh music. Bond rocks up, he takes a fancy to the blonde lady with the cello. This was my first experience of what a cello was, because, you know, growing up in a council estate in North London, you don't see many cellos. Saunders immediately is the sort of annoying one. You'd think they'd be a good double act throughout the film, and of course he does pop up again quite briefly later on. But again, sort of coming back to this sort of spy malarkey, because he's engineered the defection of Koskov from the KGB, he's one of their top officials. Does this ring true with your sort of spy, or it's more what you'd expect from a spy story?
It seems like something that could happen, certainly in a short story.
Mm.
I think Fleming's short stories are slightly more grounded in reality than the novels. I guess they don't have the scope to really get going.
They sort of swat off to the what looks like a Marxist bookshop across the road to set up, waiting for... Now, they're expecting Koskov to run across the road from this concert hall into their bookshop, and they're expecting a sniper to go after him. Now, quite why they'd send a 00 agent on this mission is a little bit strange.
I think it's because he is the best shot they've got. In the short story, he certainly goes off to the rifle range to practice his shooting. And he and Saunders have got a lot of faith in his ability, because he shoots knowing he's not going to kill. And Saunders knows that he missed on purpose. And surely, he couldn't have proved that if he'd tried to take it to some sort of industrial tribunal. I don't think he'd have had a leg to stand on.
Well, the fact that that Kara, the cello player, pops up and immediately sort of kind of thinks, right, I'm going to shoot her in the... or shoots the gun anyway out of her arm. And we find out later on that the gun that she had blanks in. And this is, again, a little bit further down the line, where Bond starts uncovering the plot that perhaps this is... everything's not all it seems. But in this part, Bond sort of does inquire himself, so why me? And he said, well, they're under the impression that you're the best.
Oh, because he's asked for personally, isn't he, by Koskov?
Yeah. And again, this is something that we get in various Bond films, that they have... He obviously meets these people on his travels. He talks later about even meeting General Pushkin. But the way that Koskov gives him this big hug when they manage to get him across the road...
Oh, I love that. It's, oh, James Bond! And Bond is very, no hugs, please, we're British.
I'm Timothy Dalton.
He's just, he's revolted by the whole idea.
One thing that I always loved when I watched it was Bond's tux... that he just sort of has a little tactical bit of Velcro.
Yes, that is beautiful. And I also like when he goes upstairs to this grotty little bedsit where he's doing his sniping, and they throw back the bedclothes and the bed is full of guns.
And he picks up the one that could probably take out a tank. That is a big gun. He's clearly meaning business. This is sort of assassin Bond. I suppose we hear... more of these days, he's referred to as an assassin.
He's a blunt instrument.
Yeah, a blunt instrument. And I think, was it in Spectre when Mr. White doesn't refer to him as a spy, he says, take the word of an assassin, because he is essentially a hired gun, goon, on behalf of the government. But as you say, he deliberately doesn't shoot Kara to kill, despite the fact he's got the sharp-nosed bullet, when he could, you know, it's James Bond with a laser-sighted rifle from not a huge distance. I mean... I could probably make that shot.
You reckon?
Yeah. As I say, we're at a balcony now. I'll take out one of the scroats around Crystal Palace.
Yeah, there's some teenagers who go up on the roof and smoke. You could probably pick one of them off.
You got a big gun?
That's a bit personal, isn't it?
That's more of a Roger Moore thing, isn't it? Koskov makes it across. Now, Saunders had this plan to get Koskov out of Bratislava into Austria in the boot of his car. Now...
just been done, hasn't it? I mean, everyone's done that.
It's been done, and Dalton immediately sort of says, scrap that, that's the first place they'd look. Now, I mean, surely most people, if you're suspecting people traffic, or, you know, that
shenanigans,
sort of thing, are going to look in the boot.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a big car, it was an Audi.
I've stood really close to that car.
Oh, was that one of the Bond in Motion ones?
No, it was in Wolfsburg, which is the town in Germany where they make Volkswagens. Yeah. And the Volkswagen Museum had a Bond car exhibition.
Oh, wow.
And I read afterwards that car lives in Audi's vault and doesn't come out often, so I was really glad I'd got the chance to stand next to it looking stupid.
You didn't try and climb in a boot?
No. Looked pretty cramped, actually.
Bond has this, you know, and he obviously has this plan lined up. It pisses Saunders off, something horrible, Armstrong. He gets to the oil pipeline, which has been rigged, and this woman who seduces her boss And again, it's someone that Bond's obviously worked with at some point.
Oh, can we talk about Julie T. Wallace? Because I love her to bits.
She's magnificent.
Isn't she? I think she might be my favourite incidental character in all of Bond, because she could easily have been a comic relief character, and it's a light-hearted scene.
Yeah.
But you're not laughing at her, you're laughing with her. Bond respects her as a professional, and he's really polite to her and doesn't hit on her, which I think is unique in Bond.
Well, this, you know, she says it's a pleasure to work with you again. It's obviously something they've done previously, but the guy, or her boss, who she has to smother to distract him, he's trying to watch a football match, and this woman comes in and sort of overpowers him.
Look, boobies!
He looks like my father-in-law.
Christ.
She sort of has this, basically smothers him in her bosom, and Bond sends Koskov off in his pipeline off to...
And it's just the way Bond would do his job.
Yeah.
He too would use sex to distract.
We kind of, again, you know, it's easy to call back to a couple of years previously. Had this been Roger Moore in that, he'd have probably made some comment going, lucky man.
There'd probably have been an awooga sound effect over the flashing of the baby's heart. She was in another film with Dalton the next year.
What was that?
Hawks.
Oh, really?
I like to think that this was because they were mates. It's a great film, and Dalton's interaction with Julie is just superb, and it's much sweeter if you've seen them in Bond.
Okay.
You've seen...
Is that a spiritual sequel?
I like to think so. She's the fun-hating ward sister in a hospital.
Right.
And Timothy Dalton is the patient trying to persuade her that he should be allowed to lick jam off her nipples.
Okay.
And she rebuffs this.
I suppose she's quite matronly in a way.
Yes, yeah.
Blimey.
Made of stern stuff. Turn down an offer like that.
She's clearly made of stronger stuff than I. Bond has got Koskov out of Bratislava. And again, this is something that, you know, we noticed looking back with current eyes, in that, you know, everything's referred to even now as Czechoslovakia. Again, countries that don't exist.
Yes. When I was at middle school, I had to learn the countries and capitals of Europe, and half of them are completely irrelevant now.
And they have to call you back and retest you.
East Germany, East Berlin, West Germany, Bonn.
Yeah. So that's how I remembered. I mean, I learned from the Panini sticker albums from World Cups and things like that, but same principle.
One thing I appreciate now, a lot of time has passed, is what a showcase of the might of the 1980s RAF we have in the living daylights. First thing you see when the film opens is a Nimrod. Then everyone jumps out of a Hercules, which is also M's flying office. Then Koskov gets whisked off in a Harrier.
Yeah.
Which is very nice.
That's a stylish way to sort of hide
it's a good
defection,
way to defect,
isn't it?
Yeah. And then you have Hercules's later, although they're probably not meant to be Hercs.
Used as glorified drugs mules.
And if you are a massive plane nerd, then when Bond touches down in Afghanistan, you go, ooh, that's an OV-10 Bronco.
See, us mere mortals just go, James Bond.
Planes.
Wings. <whoosh. laughs> Saunders has got the right arsehole, because Bond has basically come in, taken over, and said, oh, you can have all the credit. It's still your job officially. Sometimes Roger Moore's Bond came across smug in the briefings, but this is time he actually sort of took charge, but he showed very little regard for his job. I know we mentioned it sort of earlier on about how he says, if he fires me, I'll thank him for it.
He does not respect authority.
No.
He definitely doesn't respect bureaucracy.
And he doesn't respect Saunders either. That's what you get for voicing Hey Dougie. I don't know.
Does he?
Armstrong does, yeah.
don't Dougie's lines consist of woof?
Yeah, he's the narrator for Dougie.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I don't know if he does Dougie's voice or not.
Dougie is a dog of mystery.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to know that.
5 years ago, I wouldn't have known what Dougie is. Oh, kids.
Rowley, isn't it time for...
Dougie! But yeah, and that was one thing that I kind of thought... I actually sympathise with this Bond, you know, the sort of, if he fires me, I'll thank him for it. It's kind of, well...
We've all had days like that in the office.
And it kind of shows a little bit that he's the sort of slave to the machine, really. It's, you know, he can never walk away, you know, despite the fact he's clearly annoyed that he was expected to kill an amateur, and he says himself, I only kill professionals.
What would he do if he retired at early 40s? I mean, just play golf?
Hmm. Dalton doesn't strike me as a golfer.
Doesn't, does he?
No.
Not boring enough.
No. And this is, again, going back to Bond 25, or that film is said to open with Bond in retirement. So maybe we'll find out. Maybe he'll be playing a round of golf in Jamaica.
Because, yeah, double O's are supposed to be all used up around 40.
Yeah.
Which is when most of them were cast for the films.
I understand they have a very short life expectancy. Oh, we didn't mention the main part of legislation they quote throughout this film. The need-to-know basis.
Oh.
Section 26, paragraph 5. Of something. The MI6 manual or handbook or something like that.
I think the Space Corps directives in Red Dwarf have just wrecked that for me now.
And this is where, again, we mentioned in the previous episode, he says, whoever she was, I must have scared the living daylights out of her.
Boom!
Yes. Just in case you didn't know what the name of the film was, there it is in black and white.
And he doesn't overplay it, you know, it's just he just throws that out there and then leaves it.
Yeah, because there was a YouTube video, which I watched a little while ago, where they've actually cut together every Bond film where they use the title of the film. There's this one, but it follows A View to a Kill, which was the most shambolic, I think, of it.
Of it's all... not an easy mouthful to get out.
No, and even then you had to split it over two characters saying it. It was just lazy, and I know I made a joke previously, but you know they didn't say Quantum of Solace at any point, did they? But I'm sure they mentioned Bond 25 in Bond 25.
Whoever she was must have scared the living daylights out of her.
So back to London, Bond is busy, because he doesn't know, or he hasn't twigged yet who this Kara girl is that he obviously fancies.
And he hasn't got Google.
He hasn't got Google, this was pre-internet.
He has to get money to Penny to go through the microfiche.
And find the lady who was it, strangles people with her legs, which was...
What a strange concept.
Yeah.
Never going to work.
Come across a little couple of films later. And then the child with exploding teddy bears, which it just seems like they're sort of going for stereotypes of what would a Eastern Bloc assassin do?
Mm. Yeah.
Strangle with legs or exploding bear.
Those are your career options if you are a lady KGB agent.
Yeah, and of course we find out she's not a KGB agent, so it's fine.
Oh, Bond puts Moneypenny's glasses back on all wrong. Oh. Makes me wince.
It gives her a smack on the bum as well.
Yes, I feel we could live without that. Yeah. I don't think that's in character for this Bond.
I mean, you don't see it, but I think it's the point where she invites him round to listen to Barry Manilow.
I'd smack someone if I received that
across
invitation.
The face,
I think.
Hopefully, yeah. This is the first time I think we see Bond smoking in the film. After I watched the film the other day, I watched some of the extras on the iTunes, and one of the interviews was from the press conference where they'd gone to Vienna. And there were it was like a big press conference, and Timothy Dalton was there smoking, saying about how Bond is human. He has these vices. He drinks. He smokes. Mariam Dabo.
She's often got cigarette in her hand
well.
When you see her in photos.
Cubby Broccoli was smoking. Ah, the 80s.
Mariam Dabo always looks so happy in photos. It's really lovely.
Yeah.
I mean, she did some topless shots for Playboy, and she looks really happy in those too.
Yeah, because she did something, was it for ITV a couple of years ago? And I think she made this programme about reuniting old Bond girls, and she was actually kind of the main presenter of the show. And they had, I think Ursula Andress was on it, and Honor Blackman, but she was the main sort of presenter from it. But yeah, they were all smoking in this film, back when you could. Oh, memories. And we got the Ghetto Blaster. Which, any excuse to show off some cute gadgets. I think we see later, we find the couch that eats people.
Yes! Yeah, and Q's endless parade of nubile young gentlemen assistants to try these things on.
These are all just work experience people thinking, I'm going to work for an export company, yeah, it's fine. This dirty old man keeps locking me in a couch. Koskoff has been relocated to a safe house out in the country, somewhere very posh. One of these, it looks like a rest and recuperation place, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? Mm. People out doing their horse riding.
And to make it very quaint for the English people, there's a proper milkman. And
They had milkmen in the 80s.
Yeah, they did.
I remember it distinctly.
Yeah. I mean, we used to get milk delivered to our house, but then it annoyed the dog because the milkman would come stupidly early, at 4:30 in the morning. And of course, our dog would hear a milk bottles on the driveway start barking and wake the whole house up.
It.
And of course, we're sort of sitting there thinking, it's nice to have milk delivered. It's not nice being woken up at 4:30 by him. So, yeah, that was a shame.
Did he have a noisy Walkman?
No, but he. I think the milk box exploded when he hit the floor. That's probably what hit the dog up. So Necros, who incidentally was Tony from Die Hard, he was the guy who John McClane killed and wrote on his jumper.
Oh. Yeah. I've only watched Die Hard once. It is not my kind of... My mum has watched Die Hard about a dozen times because she really likes Alan Rickman.
Okay. Every Christmas?
Pretty much. Yeah. Yes, I was shocked when I learned this.
Yeah, he's the guy that John McClane kills and writes, "Now I have a machine gun on his jumper." He's got the world's worst headphones. I guess if he wore them on a tube or a bus now, someone would tell him to turn them off.
They would strangle you.
Yeah, there's a lot of sound bleeding from there of the Pretenders.
It's probably the only cassette he's got as well.
And it just plays over and over again.
Yeah.
But again, we've got another Pretenders single here. It's not... Cause that's the Where Has Everybody Gone? This one, the If There Was a Man, which is the one that plays at the end. Koskov is at this debriefing. Now, for a KGB agent who's just supposedly defected, he's got an audience of the head of MI6, or head of the 00 branch, and defence minister.
There's a lot of old white guys in that room.
Yeah, there's gammon on the menu. And Bond rocks up via Harrods with a hamper. Now, I dread to think how much this hamper cost, when even M looks at the receipt and he says he bought Bollinger.
And Bond's just thrown it all on expenses.
Yeah, and he's sort of looking, what? I'm not signing for that. And of course, Koskov's happy as anything. So he talks about the new head of the KGB who's taken over from sort of Roger Moore's nemesis, Gogol. So this is Pushkin, who was Sala in Indiana Jones.
Because I believe Gogol was supposed to be in the Pushkin role and the actor wasn't well enough.
Oh, really? Okay.
It was supposed to tie in a little more with the previous few years' worth of movies.
Yeah, because then, I mean, he does have a small cameo at the end, but it's, I suppose that maybe that was all he was...
Yeah, for. Just push him on, pull him off.
Yeah. I suppose it probably ties in a way better that you've got a new KGB head who comes in with these ideas of death to spies and reigniting the Cold War in Koskov's brain anyway. And we find out a little bit further down the line what his ulterior goals are. Now, apparently the parrot in the kitchen was the same one as For Your Eyes Only.
I'm not a parrot expert. They all look alike to me.
Someone anonymously on IMDb, who I will take as gospel because that is the sort of research I do. Necros kills the chef and has a fight with another old middle-aged white bloke. He puts up quite a good fight.
It's a heck of a fight.
Yeah, it's quite brutal.
This was one of the moments that struck me. There are a lot of scenes that in a Roger movie would have been comedy scene. I mean, it's a fight in a kitchen. Come on, there's that one. There's the scene where Bond's in a public toilet messing around with a cello case and the two blokes outside are sort of going, ooh, what's going on?
Yeah.
Would be comic in a Roger Moore film. In this one, it's a bit like they're going, ooh, this is clearly secret police business and we're just going to pretend it's not happening and hope nobody beats us up over it.
Well, I suppose this one, the guy still gets hit on the head and knocked out by a frying pan. So it's Tom and Jerry-esque.
Dialed down the sound effects for this film, mercifully.
Yeah, yeah. We've got the explosive milk bottles, which are the weapon of choice of Necros. And he kidnaps Koskov and flies him back and there's this whole thing. But
he flies off in a helicopter, which is still flying today and on the airshow circuit.
Oh, really?
I really want to see it because that would just hit various geek buttons.
It's amazing, really. I mean, I went to the Bond in Motion exhibition maybe 2 or 3 years ago in London and had all these cars, and yet you kind of think there's all these other vehicles. You know, that's just a small selection of ones that I suppose Eon or the maker still have ownership of. And yet, you know, you've already mentioned the Audi that Volkswagen have, and there's this helicopter, and there's all sorts of other ones still doing the rounds.
Yeah, there's the tank from GoldenEye, which sits outside old Buckingham Airfield and is surrounded by nettles and going rusty. Because I went and sat on it.
There's all these things that are just lying away. And we talked about it with Martin the last episode about how Eon, you know, whether they've hired these things. I suppose it's cheaper to hire a tank rather than buy one or everything else. But there's...
Return it slightly used.
I mean, right, I can't imagine in their budget for this film, they go, right, we'll buy a helicopter and then we'll make our money back from it in 30 years' time just touring it around. Mm. Yeah. I love the fact that when Koska said, who's that for? He says, you! Bash him on the head.
What a stupid question.
You're being kidnapped by the KGB. Who's that ambulance for? Come on, man.
Bond's just driven off, oblivious.
Driven off in his Aston. That was an Aston Martin.
Yeah, it's got two.
But we go back to London, and M gives a termination warrant to Bond for Pushkin based on what Koskov has told him. Now, I guess it's easy to look back and think, but what was their sort of intelligence standards like, where they will take one Soviet agent's word as gospel? We are going to kill the head of the KGB based on this man's testimony.
It's not very glasnost.
No, they've got no corresponding proof, nothing to corroborate this intel. It's just the bloke who was the baddie from The Fugitive has told us that Gimli from Lord of the Rings is bad. And then even, you know, then Bond, the job is given to him, then taken him away because of the report that Saunders wrote about the whole Bratislava incident. Which sounds like something
the from Bratislava a incident would be a great title.
That's like a John le Carré novel.
Yes. Yeah.
Not like a stag do at all.
Ooh.
Yeah. We did have a Prague incident on my mate's stag do. Yeah. So he's given the order to kill Pushkin. We go off to Q's lab, and this is where we meet the car, which isn't in this film a huge amount, but, and as we find out later, it's going to hopefully make a return in the next Bond film.
Yes.
Now, this is the Aston Martin, I had to write, Vantage V8.
I get very confused because they all start with V and there are about a million different models, but
yeah,
it's a great car. It's certainly one of my favourite Bond cars. And I've got a Corgi model in my bedroom and so on.
Well, it's the first Aston Martin Bond has had
Yes.
So, because Roger Moore didn't have one.
He didn't have one at all.
No, and I don't know.
Lazenby?
Lazenby
had one. What did Rosie drives off in one after his wedding?
But did Connery have one in Diamonds Are Forever? I don't think he did.
I don't think he did.
Yeah, so this would have been, I suppose, nearly 20 years since Bond had driven an Aston Martin. The fact that this car is appearing to make a comeback in the next Bond film, it's one of these that, you know, when I was a kid, this was the first car that I'd seen in a Bond film that had the gadgets, because, you know, previously, I'm not sure if I'd seen The Spy Who Loved Me at this point, because I was 7 or 8. But we had A View to a Kill and an Octopussy, where he had vehicles, but they weren't.
But they're not
the iconic.
They don't
Bond.
Have ejector seats.
No,
they're not all singing, all dancing.
No, I mean, he had half a Renault in Paris, and then the Tuk Tuk in Octopussy and things like that. But yeah, I mean, this was the first. I mean, this car had the skis on the side, and it was, oh, I can't remember, on the DVD extras for the film. It's a shame that they didn't have optional extras. Is when Kara quizzes him a little bit later on about these gadgets that are popping up on the windscreen.
What is this?
I've had a few optional extras installed.
Including the laser that takes the top half of a car off.
Lovely.
It's pretty special.
Did you notice at Bond in Motion that the target on the windscreen was just a sticker stuck on?
Yeah. And I wonder if this is something that will come back. I mean, again, jumping forward ahead, I mean, this car doesn't survive the film, but I guess, like, Q rebuilt the DB5 for Spectre, or no, Skyfall, wasn't it? I can't lose track of these new ones.
They'll start with S.
Yeah. But yeah, so this car is making a comeback, and it's great, and it looks, and it sounds awful because this Aston Martin's probably worth more than my house. It looks accessible in a way that perhaps the current ones and the previous ones
don't. Yes, maybe it's an 80s thing that makes it look quite, oh yeah, I could drive that.
Yeah, and the way that he can manage to get a cello or a cello case in the back, I don't think you can in the latest ones.
Ideal for the dad about town.
Yeah, he's got the kids for the weekend. He has his midlife crisis. Yeah.
Rowan Atkinson drives one in Johnny English 3. I think it's part of his extensive personal collection of cars.
Oh, what, one of these ones? Okay.
And it's bright red.
Oh,
that
right.
Was very fancyable.
Yeah. I mean, I saw yesterday you got to sit in one of the Lotus Esprits.
I did.
Wow.
I was on my lunch break and I saw it proceeding through Bromley, where I work, and turn into the Halfords car park. And it was still there a little bit later, so I thought, oh, I'll just sneak in and take a photo. And to my enormous embarrassment, the driver was still in it. And I said, oh, hi, just came to look at your car. I'm sure you get this all the time. It's a Bond car. I'm sure you get that all the time. Yeah. And he was very nice and said, oh, well, have a sit in it, see if you fit. Yeah.
Did he drop a fish out of the window or anything like that?
No. He just removed a load of his old junk off the passenger seat.
He wasn't living in it, was he?
He It's possible.
Okay. I mean, I live near Fulham Football Club's training ground, so I see a lot of expensive cars sort of up and down, but I don't, yeah, never see one of these. Bond has gone back to Bratislava to track down Kara and the whole situation about there. Now, I've written, she gets pulled off the tram, FNAF, and this is where you mentioned earlier about how Bond takes the cello case, because he finds the cello case, he takes that to the toilets. Now, again, in a different scenario, this would be the setup for some sort of sketch or a gag. I mean, it's the sort of thing like, I'm sure Derek and Clive did something along these lines, but...
It's a bit like Leslie Nielsen vanishing into the men's room in The Naked Gun and forgetting he's still mic'd up.
Yeah. He's in this stall fiddling around with a gun. I suppose these days that would be a blue light or a red light for someone with mental health issues, but she gets kidnapped by the KGB. Bond goes back to her flat because she has left her name in this cello case with a rifle.
Tell she's not a KGB agent.
She's not very clever. He goes back and he starts this whole routine that he's Koskov's friend. And that, oh yes, yeah, we're just trying to track him down, and you know,
we just want a word with him.
Yeah, but you know, obviously you're his girlfriend, so
you're not in trouble.
Yeah, honest.
Just want a word.
You're not an accessory to defection and trying to have a rifle and everything like that. They sneak off in the car. She gets very funny about this cello, which we find a little bit later on is worth, again, stupid amounts, probably worth more than that car.
Mm.
And this is where we see another moment of Bond being grumpy and intolerant, and this is, it's like dealing with a toddler. She is trying to get this cello in the car and he's like, quickly, and there's just this eye rolling that only Dalton can do.
Yes.
Roger Moore's, it's almost like his eye movements, you know, Roger Moore was famous for his eyebrow. He's like, well, I'll do the eye roll.
He has very nice eyelashes, I'm just saying. If I were to list his best features, that would be in the top three.
Eyelashes, what are the other three?
Cheekbones, hands.
Starting to swoon a bit here.
We don't know what happens in the comedy cut between no way are we going back for your cello and oh, here we are in the car with the cello. We don't know what favours she might have offered him.
I mean, I suppose if she's like the toddler to roll his eyes, it probably had to promise her an ice cream.
Mm. She lay on the pavement and beat her fists on the ground.
Have a little tantrum.
Yeah. I did wonder when they pull this subterfuge to... Mm. Get out of the flat. It's very clever. You see Kara going off to the phone box and the KGB watcher keeping an eye on her. And then a tram goes past. And in the space of a couple of carriages of tram passing, she's put her hat and coat on a cello case and hopped in the car.
Yeah.
And I did wonder, I thought, you know, she's not been trained. She probably wouldn't be very good at that. Did, in fact, Bond come out of the flat in drag and do that?
No, I mean, he's a spy, he's professional, but, you know, he's playing a role already as Koskov's friend. He could be Koskov's girlfriend as well. We live in modern times.
It took him a while to get into the role.
Yeah, he's method, isn't he?
Yeah.
I don't know, I didn't notice, did the tram stop for a while, and it was one of these, like, you get on the London buses, and this tram is being held here to regulate the service, and it was actually there for 20 minutes while we were waiting. But yeah, so they've snuck off, and they're driving off, and... He picks up the police radio on his car radio, and Dalton, who's speaking all these...
There must be an atmospheric anomaly.
Yeah, and I'm sure, like, is her English good enough?
She's probably just going, yes, definitely
yes,
that.
Yes, yes. And
She looks like someone who's had a lot of mansplaining in her life.
He just patted her on the head.
Just nod.
Good things, yeah.
And she's got to translate it for him, because he doesn't speak Czech.
Well, I'm amazed he doesn't, because he knows Afghan later on.
He's better at Afghan than German, because the way he says danke is just appalling. I'm not sure if it's as bad as the way Brosnan delivers German in Tomorrow Never Dies.
Oh, that was bad. Mein Büro hat ein Auto reserviert.
Pierce Brosnan does Kraftwerk.
Nein.
Mein Büro hat ein Auto.
He's got one of those little speak and spell sort of thing. The cop car pulls alongside him. Was this a Skoda? I can't think now.
Lada, I think it is.
Oh, thank God, because I drive a Skoda now. But this is where, so the laser comes out the wheel of the Aston Martin and basically slices the chassis off. And it's a salt corrosion. Welsh as F.
Oh.
Salt corrosion.
What happened?
Salt corrosion.
Look you.
So the cop car comes off. He's then, this is just where the car becomes brilliant. He's got the missiles coming out of the fog lights to shoot the truck that they try and block the road with. And as you said earlier, the sights on the windscreen.
The afterburner. I love that.
Oh, yes. Brace yourself.
Oh, I would. And I'm a particular fan of the way he turns getting the tyre shot out to his advantage by doing a circle on the ice around the car.
It's funny that when you see... Now, you don't realise what he's doing, but he's cutting his... And then when the car... The cop car sort of follows onto this circle of ice is tiny. Mm. It's got like the turning, it's almost like the Aston Martin's got a turning circle of a cab. It's managed to do this fine, tiny little circle just enough for the car to get on. Precision, ice cutting. This is where he got stuck in the shed. As you do.
Again, should have been comedy. Actually, it's quite dramatic.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. And I guess with Bond films, you can always think about how would this film have been with a different Bond? And I suppose, you know, after 7 Roger Moore films, you can talk about how the whole franchise or series needed a bit of a change. And you see even the change from Moonraker, you know, space to For Your Eyes Only, Grease, and more kicking a car off the edge. And all of a sudden this has gone, you know, even more so. At the time, it must have been quite a shock to people who were even casual Bond fans.
I just can't imagine the mentality of someone who has sat through A View to a Kill and 2 years later this turns up and they go, it's different, I don't like it.
Why isn't he molesting that young girl? Yes, weird. Why is he not pretending to be a posh Englishman? St. John Smythe. So this car grows skis because it's got no tyres. And the afterburner goes through the trees. And he presses self-destruct on the car. I don't know, maybe Q must have another one in the garage for the next film. Something I'll always remember is the slide down in the cello case.
Yes, I love that.
It's, was it someone told me once, what's the word? Foreshadowing. Where, of course, they've made a big deal about getting this cello case into the car. And, of course, this cello case becomes incredibly useful. Sort of 5 minutes down the line.
Yes, beating many of Q's gadgets.
Yeah. Of course, he's the very good nothing to declare as he crosses into the Austrian. It's an odd place to have a border.
Doc! We've nothing to declare!
I entered Slovenia from Austria and there was nothing there at all. In fact, I think my partner and I went through about 5 countries before anyone bothered to ask if we had passports.
We get a cutscene to Tangier where Pushkin arrives to meet Brad Whittaker, who is supposed to be the mastermind of the piece. A brash American. It turns out to be an arms dealer and not these pretensions of a military career that Pushkin pulls him up on. This was something when I was a kid I didn't get. I do now, I suppose. But for the casual observer, there's this sort of little subplot about, you know, you've got Death to Spies, and I suppose it's made to appear that Pushkin, at this point, we don't know which side of the fence he sits on. Is he buying futuristic weapons from someone who later becomes Bond's ally?
Oh, see, this is one of my most watched Bond films. Probably seen it a dozen or so times, and I'm only now beginning to pull together what on earth is happening, because it's Bond, you don't think. You just go along for the ride.
Yeah.
No. Oh, look, a baddie.
Don't pull that, Fred. Yeah. Now we'll come back to that later. Bond and Kara in Vienna, and again, this is something that we talk about, Bond being the world's worst spy. He rocks up to an Austrian hotel. Ah, oh, Mr. Bond, the usual suite, which I get when I go to my local Premier Inn for breakfast.
It's a great fantasy, though, isn't it? I'd love to rock up at hotels all over the world and be recognised. I especially like it in Die Another Day when Pierce shows up, hairy and half naked, and they go, "Ah, Mr. Bond, welcome."
The presidential suite, of course.
I see you don't have your credit card on you, but
please come in. Again, we've got another typical villain pool, and this is where we see Koskoff and Whittaker together. Jerome Crabbe was really played this part really well of Koskoff, but again, I kind of see him as almost the baddie from The Fugitive as much as this. But it's funny, like, and again, maybe it was, he looks quite similar, but you could imagine if this was now, and or they made this film now, and this would be a better role for Christoph Waltz.
Ooh, yes.
I had in my head, because he's got that, and again, having, I quite recently watched Inglourious Basterds, where it is that kind of gentle comedy side.
Yes, good at switching between affable and you're right bastard.
Yeah, and this is where Koskov is. You know, he does that pretty well throughout. And I think this is a conversation I had when went to see License to Kill a couple of weeks ago, and I had a conversation with Terry about it. And we were talking about sort of villains throughout and how some villains are more iconic than others. And you kind of think, like, you know, one of my favourite Bond films is The Spy Who Loved Me. And yet the villain in that, or there's a lot of people think that Jaws, you know, remember Jaws more fondly than Stromberg. But then you look at Moonraker, which, you know, is a ridiculous film. I love it. It's crazy. And Drax in that was by far the best part of that film, in a way that perhaps Zorin was in A View to a Kill. And you kind of think that, have they spread themselves a little bit too thin here with Koskov? Could he have been a main villain on his own without needing the American arms dealer in there as well?
Yes, it seems like a distraction, really, yeah. And a bit of an excuse to have that fight at the end among all the toy guns.
Especially, they've got this plot hatching where they'll get Bond to kill Pushkin instead of them, and how it advances their plans for not even world domination.
Well, no, it's all quite small scale, isn't it? You think it's a big global East versus West plot, and actually it's a couple of guys on the make.
Selling drugs to buy guns and vice versa. Crazy. Now, in Austria, we've got Bond and Saunders again. They're starting to get to grips with the plot that perhaps Koskov isn't, and we already know this now, but Koskov isn't the sort of the good guy from the KGB. He's actually involved, and, you know, the fact that Brad Whittaker had paid for Kara's cello, because it's a Stradivarius and they all have names. He says, all right, we need to get her out of the country. And they say they'll meet at the cafe in Vienna. I've never been to Vienna, I don't know, but apparently the Ferris wheel is a big iconic thing. Necros pops up looking like the geezer from Up with all his balloons.
There's quite a lengthy set piece in Vienna, first when they arrive and then at the fairground, where it is just Bond and Kara doing stuff.
Yeah.
I don't think that is repeated anywhere in Bond except in On Her Majesty's Secret Service when Lazenby gets his great falling in love with Diana Rigg montage.
Yeah, this one isn't as lean, perhaps. I mean, in a lot of parts there is, but there are parts where this, I mean, again, it's part of the act that he's pretending, you know, getting Kara to fall in love with him because, of course, he's Timothy Dalton and she's only human. But the Austrian, the guy who runs the Ferris wheel, when they get off kissing, when they're kissing, is, would you like another ride? That's probably the only English phrase he knows.
But yes, Roger Moore would have raised an eyebrow at that. just push that point a little more,
yeah,
as it were.
Necros kills Saunders by setting up the glass door to close on him.
Risky strategy, but
yeah,
it's a shame because Saunders was just learning to break rules and be like his new friend Mr. Bond. It is a beginning of a beautiful friendship moment.
This is the problem, he should have stuck to counting beans.
See where it gets you. Breaking the rules,
being a only Bond can be a renegade.
But really, I mean, he could have been the film's Felix. He could have been Bond's buddy.
Yeah, I mean, maybe this is, I guess, not what they were setting up for, but again, this is kind of where Bond needs his allies, you know. And again, we'll meet Felix very soon, or new Felix, or then Felix, or something. But again, this is kind of Bond's problem with, and I guess at least in this case, it's not a woman, but, you know, someone falls for Bond's charms, at least in a professional work environment, and meets a, I was going to say a sticky end, but a sharp end of a glass.
Shocking
door.
End. Yeah.
And then, just as he's sort of lying there covered in blood, a balloon with Spjolman bobbles across. Necros must have had a little marker pen. It must be his hand. But then, the handwriting on the balloon is the same as the handwriting on the tag.
Ooh, as if someone back at base was writing these out.
Yeah, but again, that's planning if you've written it on a balloon.
And you'd have to write it really small on the balloon for it to look the normal size when you blow it up.
Well, you blow it up, write on it, and then deflate it again. Is that right? Use this one. Oh, I don't know. If only he'd just stuck to lifting his house up to wherever. I've only seen a bit of that.
And this poor little boy who is up way past his bedtime having a trip to the fun fair with his balloons and is suddenly pounced on by Bond.
It's supposed to be they meet in midnight, don't they, in the cafe, and all of a sudden, and they're walking along with these balloons, and Bond vaults this gate and pulls a gun on him. And this kid's going to post-traumatic stress. I mean,
my theory is his parents are getting divorced, and that's why he's been taken to the fun fair at midnight and given a ton of balloons.
We still love you, it's okay. Don't worry about the giant, handsome Welshman pulling a gun on you. in a tuxedo in a fairground fancy dress. I don't know. So Bond goes to Tangiers to start his sort of spying. He's got these really cool binocular glasses that I think everyone's seen the GIF from. He's waiting in the hotel room for Pushkin. And this is when, I think this is one of the few times we see a nipple in a Bond film. I had to make a note of that.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Seeing that on a large screen at 7, I didn't know what to make of that. Bond confronts Pushkin and implies that because Bond has been given orders to kill him, but Bond has since found out that perhaps Koskov is full of shit. You know, because he says, if I believed Koskov, we wouldn't be talking. You know, again, this is Bond being a professional assassin.
Mm, and a professional dick as well.
Yeah, but he's, you know, he's ripped a woman's dressing gown off.
He does a bit of that, and it's always part of his professional job. I mean, he does it to Pushkin's wife so he can throw her at the guard. And then later he grabs Kara and starts ripping her clothes off, but yeah, it's so he can point at the wound on her arm and go, look, I did that.
I made you hurt.
I'm trying to endear myself to you by pointing out that I shot you.
Looking at that now, he's like, he disrobes an attractive lady in front, going, look, boobs.
Yeah. Much as Julie T. Wallace did earlier. That's probably where he got the idea.
Blimey. It worked, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Twice in one film.
You should do that more often now. Not cheering up.
I would love to see Daniel Craig do that. At least he never did it with Judi Dench.
Oh, yeah.
Take it!
Pushkin says, then I must die. This is, again, we'll come to shortly, where we have to fake his death to kind of double bluff Koskov out, you know, call him out into the open so we can see his plan. Now, this is something I wrote down because I know I saw you talking about on Twitter a couple of weeks ago. Bond shoots Pushkin, who's wearing a bulletproof vest and squibs, and decides to make his way across the rooftops of Tangiers, twanging aerials and so on. Something we were spared, thank God, but there are photos which I've got on my phone which I'll show you. There was a scene where Bond was supposed to ride a magic carpet. Thank Christ they cut that out.
I think it would have worked, because we've seen that this is a film that turns potential comedy moments into very serious dramatic ones.
Imagine, and this is the thing, had it happened a couple of years previously, that would have stayed in the film.
Yes.
And I'm trying to look for it now.
But Dalton's face is a picture, isn't it? It's so disgusted.
Yeah. He's just like, I've
done Shakespeare, you know.
I've done Flash Gordon, it was more serious than this. I mean, the whole thing is just crazy. And yet, this was a film that was trying to take itself more seriously and everything like that.
Funny thing is, for years I was convinced that that had been in the movie and I'd seen it because I'd read so much talk about it.
But I don't think they even completed the scene, did they? It's not like it exists somewhere as a deleted scene. I think there's photographs, production stills of them trying to set it up, but I don't think they actually, surely that must have done the rounds.
I don't want to see Bond outtakes because I don't want to see Bond break character. Because I've watched some Doctor Who outtakes, and while they're very funny, I think, oh, no, I don't want Sylvester McCoy saying naughty words. That's not something I need in my head.
Did you see the ones from A View to a Kill?
No.
There was one, no, there were two that I hadn't seen before I did the podcast, and I was told. There's one where Bond was in prison in Paris after jumping into that couple's cake, and as he was being bailed out of the French prison, they had a very crazy a lighter that kind of, which burnt off the police officer's eyebrows, and he said, "Oh, from Russia with love," ooh. And it was Roger Moore saying that, and it was all very strange. But there was also one where Stacey had been fired from her job in San Francisco, and Bond said something like, "Oh, you know, don't worry, Stacey, fuck him."
We are going to meet with a friend of mine from Washington, and maybe, just maybe, he'll come up with a few answers. All right?
I just can't believe it.
Well, life is short. I mean, f*** him. You know, who needs it?
You know, this is Roger Moore saying, f*** him. And if you could hear all the crew laughing, and, you know, this is probably why I didn't make it into the film.
Oh, I've seen, I think it might even have been an outtake from The Saint, so a bit right earlier. Yeah, somebody drops something and he just goes, oh, yeah, fuck it.
Yeah, but you think Dalton would take these things far too seriously. I mean, he clearly has a sense of humour, but I think at this time he's trying to craft a niche as Bond. Mm. I mean, we can go into later about what happened there, but I mean, we even in Hot Fuzz, you know, and I guess that's what a lot of people have seen him in perhaps more recently. I mean, you know, he's playing a very hammy supermarket manager there. The only thing I'm slashing is prices. It worked. Bond gets captured by Felix Leiter's angels. I didn't realise that Felix Leiter in this film was played by an actor called John Terry.
It fits somehow. He's, yeah, he's a bit of a forgettable Felix. You don't get the sense that
they're
pals, even though they are wearing the matching polo shirt and anorak combo, like the bros they are.
There's a lot of beige going on.
Yeah.
So he's taking it, and this is where the CIA sort of coming in. Now, Koskov gets a phone call from Kara, because obviously she's realised that Koskov's still alive. She's managed to get hold of him because Bond has said, I think they've made the connection between Koskov and Whittaker. And then this is where that sort of really intense kind of crash zoom goes in right on Koskov's face. He goes, oh my God, what's going on? This is the part where you mentioned about how Kara spikes his drink.
Mm.
And, I mean, he's downs a martini in one go.
It's not going to do much good, even if it's not spiked, is
it?
No,
and then immediately works out what sort of chemical's in there, and then rips her dressing gown, luckily just the sleeve this time, and I think this is where she kind of realises, she seems to switch sides quite quickly.
Yes.
They're taken onto a plane with a heart transplant. This is where the diamonds in the ice of the animal heart.
Ken, this is really complex. Yeah. Did we need that?
So this is Koskov using diamonds to take to Afghanistan to buy drugs.
And he might as well throw Bond and his girlfriend in prison while they're there.
I think so.
Just drop them out of the plane somewhere over the ocean. Why not do that?
He takes them to an Afghan prison, a Russian airbase in Afghanistan. You know, again, like you say, quite easily kill him. Yeah. Don't make a big deal of it.
I want you to meet Daddy's nemesis, Austin Powers.
What, are you feeding him? Why don't you just kill him?
No, Scott, I have an even better idea. I'm going to place him in an easily escapable situation involving an overly elaborate and exotic death.
You would think that this prison would be full of soldiers who'd been on a drunken disorderly rather than horse thieves.
Instead, you've got a very scouse man who'd been in Brookside, just happens to be like the head of the Mujahideen in there just for some spying charge, but they didn't realise who he was.
Now, the first time I watched The Living Daylights at my boarding school in the common room, I watched it with my friend Sadia, who wanted to see it because her uncle Art Malik was in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And that there was actually some teen girl drama because we were supposed to be another girl's birthday party and we bunked off to watch a Bond film. I regret nothing.
I remember, I think it would have been around this time, and I'd seen Art Malik in, there was some show, and because I think he lived quite near us. We lived in Islington at the time. And I think he lived quite nearby, and I don't know if he had a kid at our school or something like that, because, I mean, it was a weird time, because Salman Rushdie's son was in my class at school around that time, and that caused some issues. But Art Malik was in this show about, I think it was involving, He had an English wife, and he was playing standard Middle Eastern, or, you know, that sort of character who had kidnapped his child and taken them back to whichever country it was. And I remember this being, I don't think it was quite as big as, say, Line of Duty or Bodyguard today or anything like that, but that was quite a big thing. But yeah, I'm sure he had a kid at our school or something like that. It wasn't just Salman Rushdie. God, what a weird time. Anyway, we saw him later in True Lies, he was fine. They escape from this prison after beating up the Scouse man using Bond's whistling keyring. This was something I've seen this film dozens of times. I genuinely didn't remember until I seen it this week how Shah Art Malik rides back into the camp as a hero. Everyone's cheering him, and, you know, we just see him as this slightly, I wouldn't say hapless, but
yeah, I had forgotten all the camels. It's not a forgettable animal.
No. But he sort of rides back into this camp as this sort of returning king, and you go, okay. And it turns out he's this Oxford-educated, as everyone is, you know.
Oh, yes. But
I suppose him and Bond should be rivals, really.
I was going to say, I'm astounded he didn't know Bond, and the guy in The Spy Who Loved Me did.
Well, they were from Cambridge, weren't they?
So sure, Bond was Oxford.
Should we Google that? Yeah, let's Google that, because we're really professional here.
He learns Danish at Oxford.
Oh, yeah, he brushes up a little Danish.
Yeah, yeah.
Bond University. Yeah. It's probably going to take me to some dodgy... Yeah, Bond University, Australia's number one. No, that's not right.
It's Bondi University.
Yeah. James Bond went to Cambridge.
Yeah. Oh, well, I beg his pardon.
Yeah.
But yeah, so they must have known each other from the boat race or something. And, yeah, so been down the Thames at Putney or something like that.
Intercollegiate drinking clubs.
Yeah, some varsity rugby match or something like that. And this is where there's the whole plot around carry on up the Khyber. There's $500 million of raw opium, which again, Bond manages to lick a knife and knows it's raw opium, just like, was it for your eyes only? That was raw opium as well.
At what stage in the MI6 recruitment process do they do drug tasting?
So within 10 minutes, Bond has worked out that he's had chloral hydrate in his martini and raw opium. He also knows that the heart in the icebox isn't a human heart. He's led a dark life, hasn't he?
He probably worked in a butcher's as a summer job.
And all this opium apparently is being transported in Red Cross bags. Now, this was something, again, that I noticed where they had to have a disclaimer in the credits, because the Red Cross had raised, we don't do drugs, we don't deal drugs. You might need to clarify that, you know.
We don't kidnap Russian generals either.
Honestly, yeah, I mean, the Red Cross does not stand for these things. And this kind of goes on a bit. And this is something, again, I mean, this podcast goes on some weird tangents. This film came out the year before Rambo 3, which was dedicated to the brave soldiers of Afghanistan and the Taliban.
Gosh.
Yeah, how times change. And in this...
Art Malik,
yeah, he's great. Bond sneaks explosives into a bag onto the plane. They get onto the plane.
The whole plane bit is my absolute favourite.
At one point, Kara goes off... Because Bond goes off to do this Bond thing. Kara says to Khan, aren't you going to help him? And then she nicks his gun and rides off, and he just sort of tuts and rolls his eyes and goes, oh, women...
Pretty much what Bond would have done. So, right then.
Kindred spirits.
Oh, we'll go back for your cello. Oh, we'll pursue you into the enemy's camp.
Yeah, let's go back onto the Russian airbase in the middle of Afghanistan. So the Afghan army, they sort of invade this prison camp as Bond...
Probably been looking for an excuse for weeks.
Yeah, but of course they've got $500 million worth of opium to pursue. Bond gets onto the plane, and this is quite interesting because Bond tries to fly the plane off with all the drugs. And then Necros, because they're trying to, but they can't shoot the plane because they destroy the plane, as Koskov keeps telling us. It's a little bit of exposition. They go,
because the audience is going, why don't you just shoot the plane?
Yeah, don't shoot the nuclear weapon.
Why didn't you shoot Bond 20 minutes ago?
You know, all those times you could have thrown him out of the plane or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And now look what's happened. Yeah.
This is where Austin Powers got it from. And again, I've written more eye rolling as Kara drives along the plane in the Jeep that she's nicked. And
it's why can't you understand my perfectly clear hand signal?
You're in a Jeep looking at me, looking out of a plane window, eye rolling galore. She manages, but she shouts James a lot. Now, this is something I think we calculated in the View to a Kill episode. Stacy shouted James, something like 15 or 16 times. And I'm sure Kara.
Just in this one scene, yes, there are annoying levels of James shouting.
We're into double figures here. But the best part of this was the fight, where the plane takes off. Kara and Bond think they're kind of getting away with this. And as Bond goes to defuse the bomb that he just happened to leave on the plane, Necros goes on. And
it's a very Bond thing, isn't it? You think you're safe and suddenly bad guy.
Here comes big KGB agent.
Also, he leaves Kara flying the plane and she has no idea how to do it. Has she never seen a single film?
I mean, she's not really watching. She's pressing lots of buttons because she's the one who opens the hatch.
That is, yeah.
Yeah.
I have very fond memories of how amusing my dad and I found it when she finds the lever marked down and goes, oh, of course, that's how to make the plane go down.
Oh.
But pretty sure she doesn't know what she's done there at all.
I mean, it's an odd... I'm not really one for planes or anything, but it's an odd sort of setup. I suppose it's mainly used for transporting cargo and things like that. But, yeah, I mean, it just looks like... I just look around and there's the Jeep and...
It was funny it had a wheel clamp just the right size for a Jeep to roll straight into.
And it had the little cabin above that they had the... where they were sitting on the way there. It was the same plane, wasn't it?
Pretty much. I've jumped out of the back of the Hercules.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It was on the ground at the time.
Were you holding Timothy Dalton's boot?
I'm pretending I was. They had it at an air show for little kids to jump out of the back onto a mattress, and obviously I did it.
Yeah. Now, this, again, is another death. I mean, we had a similar one in Octopussy. Bond and Necros have this fight, and eventually Necros is holding onto Bond's boot. I mean, they must be travelling at several dozen thousand feet.
Mm.
And that, what a horrible way to die. I'm not saying he doesn't deserve it, but
yeah.
God, dropping that far, holding a boot that probably smells like roses. But, oh God, horrible. And then we get he got the boot. Yeah, decent. Yeah. I'm sure Moore would have done better with that one, but then you can't imagine him killing an elite KGB agent quite so easily.
No.
Were there headbutts in that one? This is where, as you say, Kara's about to fly the plane straight into a mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly has no idea until Bond comes back and tells her.
But then Bond's master plan is to drive the Jeep out of the back of it rather than try to land the Hercules on the perfectly good road that is right there.
But luckily, the Jeep comes out the back, he lands on the road, the plane crashes, and he knows a very good restaurant in Karachi, which is, was it about 200 miles, I think, from where they landed?
And presumably he walks into this restaurant still only wearing one boot.
Yeah, and he drives in one boot, which must be weird.
Yeah.
And plus, I'm not one for politics or, you know, political tensions of the 80s, but if he's crossing from Afghanistan into Pakistan...
You think they'll have questions?
Yeah. With
like,
one boot.
Why do you only have one boot on?
Yeah. Why are you driving this Jeep? Yeah, it's all very strange. And then the sort of final showdown, we go to Whittaker's place in Tangiers again. Whittaker, who is a sort of man in his 40s, I guess, playing toy soldiers, is very much like a sort of Games Workshop sort of thing.
Yeah.
He's got a very trendy setup with all his sound effects and that, though.
That's where all his arms dealing money goes.
He's like a 15-year-old in his room.
With the giant remote control as well, which is probably on a physical wire.
Yeah. It's a good job he was playing toy soldiers and not doing something else. That was dodgy when Bond bursts in on him.
It's a good job they hadn't really invented video games yet.
Yeah. Bond goes in and Whittaker questions him, says, "You blew up $500 million. And again, when I was a kid, I was like, $500 million, what was that? Like 20 quid?
$1 billion!
And it's strange, like, he distracts Bond with a drawer by remote control. It's the sort of thing you'd catch an old person out on. And gets these guns, and it's just a strange little fight. Again,
he's got a lot of live ammo in his toy soldier setup. You'd think it would work out expensive.
Yeah, I mean, you never know when these rogue British agents will come in. But these were, I guess, the samples that he was going to try and sell to the KGB, and... sort of had him lurking around. But Bond manages to kill him by putting his explosive keyring on a statue, and quite clever. But
it's not often you get a multiple use gadget.
No, he's got stun gas.
Credit to him for
So stun gas, a skeleton key, and an explosive.
He uses them all.
Yeah. So how convenient.
Yeah, when he's filling in his report afterwards.
And then of course he gets a new one shortly afterwards. But we mentioned it earlier. I mean, as a bad guy, Whittaker is. I mean, this film is a very strong one, and I know it's a lot of people's, you know, all-time favourite, and certainly for me it's in the top five. But Whittaker's, as a bad guy, is pretty forgettable, really.
Yes, you wouldn't place him in the top five.
No. I mean, he serves a purpose, but again, remove that purpose and rewrite the film slightly and perhaps make Koskoff a main villain.
I mean, Whittaker hasn't got a scar, hasn't got a funny accent, not a lot to work with here.
No, and he's just... It just comes across as a brash American. Is that really a thing? Hey-ho. He came back late. We saw him soon. He was working for the CIA all along.
Yes.
Oh, what do we know? And, of course, Koskoff just happened to be in the house at the same time when Pushkin and his goons come in to sort of save Bond.
And, yeah, they rescue Bond.
Yeah.
He does require a bit of cavalry coming in.
You know, he's killed the bad guy, but, yeah, you forget about the bad guy's goons.
Mm.
He must hear all these explosions and gunshots in there and go, oh, what's going on?
Well, I'm knocking off in 10 minutes. Yeah. I'm just going to pretend I didn't hear that.
My shift finished. It's fine. Pushkin comes in and sends Koskoff off to Moscow in a diplomatic bag, which I guess must be a bad thing. I can't imagine it's very comfortable.
I think they're quite small.
Yeah. They're like being sent in by Postman Pat or something like that.
Sent second class.
Oh, God. That'd be dreadful. Oh, God. Not even first class.
Sent by Yodel.
Oh, he'd be thrown over and left in a wheelie bin or something like that.
Jumped up and down on.
The Moscow embassy gets a card through the door saying, well, while you were out.
Yeah. I was in all morning!
We left this man-shaped bag under the back seat of your car.
Oh. You did not ring the doorbell.
It's very damaged. And the final scene, Kara... And as we see from the poster, Kara Milovi is doing a world tour. Now, she's done well because on this world tour, the composer is John Barry.
He probably wrote something specially for her.
I hope so. And I suppose for him, I mean, this, I don't know how many Bond films did he score. I know maybe 10, 11 at this
Certainly
point.
Certainly lots, yeah.
And this was his farewell as well. This was the last Bond film he scored. He gets a nice little cameo at the end.
Yes, I only found that out recently. That's really nice. It'd probably been saying for years, you know, there are never any musician characters in these films, and that would be really good.
Do I have to pay tax on this one? Yeah. Gogol appears, you know, in his cameo as the, was it the Foreign Tourist Board or something of the Soviet Union?
Yeah.
He arranges a tour.
His pre-pension job.
Yeah, get yourself something nice just to see out your final years. He says he'll sort out Kara because she's still technically a defector of some sort, so he sorts her out a tourist visa or something. Cameron Shaw and his men burst into this tourist hall, concert hall.
Cameron Shaw would definitely own Black Tie.
Yeah.
He's not making much effort here.
And you get the sort of... the line was, oh, we had some trouble at customs, and that sort of very stoic British, I can't imagine why.
And Cara's very, oh, the lads, aren't they funny? Bless them.
Oh, jaunty japes. she retires to her dressing room because James Bond is on assignment and couldn't make the concert because he's hiding in her dressing room with his playing with his key ring. Yeah. And that's it. What a film.
Yeah, it is my favourite Bond. I'll nail my colours to the mast then.
And I mean, again, we'll talk about this. There's still one more 80s Bond film to do, sort of License to Kill. But, I mean, we... Not together, but we both saw License to Kill at the cinema quite recently, and you know, I think there's been a lot of revisiting of Dalton's tenure of Bond.
Yes, a lot of it in the light of Daniel Craig being this more serious Bond.
Yeah, it's funny because at the time it seemed like because it was such a departure from Roger Moore, and then followed by Pierce Brosnan, who I guess was more than anyone else. Dalton seemed like the anomaly, whereas I guess now. People looking back think that, you know, maybe that's what the character was more likely to be all along.
I definitely feel there is a sort of pendulum swing from comic to serious, and we've seen it twice. And also, the previous Bond is in the doghouse because I collected a lot of newspaper clippings and things in the lead up to GoldenEye because I was very excited. And everyone, when Brosnan was Bond and sort of taking it back to Roger Moore territory. Everyone took enormous pleasure in pissing all over Dalton. And then when Craig was cast, everyone went, oh, Pierce Brosnan, yeah, that was a bit silly, wasn't it?
I mean, it's funny looking back, and I know, you know, that the whole issue between... So there was 6 years between License to Kill and GoldenEye, and there were, and there should have really been, I think, a Dalton, a third Dalton Bond film at some point, which would have been... It was supposed to be GoldenEye to some extent, wasn't it?
I doubt it would have been quite the GoldenEye we got. But,
I mean, this would have been at around the end of communism, so it would have been a lot more closer to that time. And even then, I mean, I think in GoldenEye, wasn't there a 6 or 7 year time lapse between the first part and the second part?
When...
So I suppose, you know, that must have been an exact follow-on, you know, almost like the next mission for Bond after License to Kill. And then we had the six-year gap and that. But, yeah, we talked about it earlier when Pierce Brosnan was so close to being, and at one point was actually cast as Bond for this film. And bear in mind, I mean, this would have been 8 years before GoldenEye. That would have been a strange one as well. You know, we're talking a TV show contract away from having Pierce Brosnan doing The Living Daylights.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hella glad he didn't, but it is rough luck on him.
Yeah. But then Dalton was close to being Bond a couple of times before this as well, wasn't
he?
Could you have seen him in Moonraker or anything like that?
Well, I could have seen him in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, which I think was around the time he's supposed to have turned it down because he thought he was a bit young.
He's probably got a point. I mean, that would have been nearly 20 years before this.
If you look at him in Sextet with Mae West, I mean, God, don't look at Sextet, but there it is.
It's on YouTube, I believe.
I think it's 78, and Dalton spends this film running around in morning dress.
Yeah.
And he's noticeably younger and quite skinny. And I look at that and think, that could have been him in On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Imagine that.
You didn't think I'd miss this performance, did you?
That was The Living Daylights. Alice, thank you very much for joining us for the podcast. I'm going to use the inspiration from your record collection to play out the podcast, because for the Bond ones, I've done something a bit different from each one. We've had Blondie's theme tune for Your Eyes Only.
That was fabulous. I had no idea it existed.
Not did
I.
That was a bonus.
Wow.
The Ted version of All Time High. We had the live Duran Duran mess-up of A View to a Kill at the Live Aid. But this time we're going to have The Pretenders and the song that actually played out the film. So it's If There Was a Man. And from the 7-inch single, which Alice has got here, which I'll be very careful with, the sleeve art is magnificent. You've got Dalton leaning against what looks like a bit of scaffolding in full dinner suit, and Cara in a very shiny gown, looking very demure.
No idea what they're up to, but it's incredibly sexy.
Yeah, and this is probably just before he rips the sleeve off the dressing gown to see her, wound. And on the back got Chrissie Hynde.
Doing the finger guns.
Yeah. Anyway, Alice, thank you very much for coming along.
Oh, thank you for letting me rant about my favourite Bond film.
And lots of planes, which I know nothing about. I'll speak to you soon.
Bye.
This podcast is brought to you by executive producers Gary West, Fergus Higginson, Keith Foster, Jimmy Fletcher, Mark Drakes, Matt Cunnington, Christian Dees, and Andy Elliott, and associate producer Chris Oakley. Visit patreon.com/Betamax Video Club for more information about bonus episodes, early access, and more. Don't forget to rate and review the podcast on iTunes and subscribe to be the first to hear new episodes.